All right, welcome back to the Buffalo Bread Podcast. JJ here with Dan. And, you know, after this past week, there's a lot of Buffalo Bills Mafia out there feeling a lot of different ways. We had what many refer to as Red Wednesday this week. It was a hard time. From no news at all for so long to a flurry of roster moves, restructures, cuts, and just a lot of different things happening that, you know, I think a lot of people in the world of sports media have been expecting some of these things, but certainly not all the things. Dan, where do you want to start? How are you feeling? How have you recovered from Wednesday?
You know, we are very purposefully, JJ. We are not a reaction pod. We are a once a week, we kind of take it all in 6 days a week, and then we give measured and reasoned responses to everything we see happening in Buffalo Bills world on that seventh day. And this was the first time, I think, in 3-4 years that we've been doing this pod where I really just wanted to give a reaction to what I was seeing on Wednesday. It was very surprising. I don't think when you take the moves individually is the right way to describe it. But when taken in totality, and when you look at the stark contrast between what Bean did on Wednesday versus how other teams, like the Saints and the Rams being two notable examples, how they choose to manage their veteran player and their veteran cap numbers, I mean, I think it is safe to say that this was a novel and not quite seen before approach to roster reconstruction on the fly in the modern NFL. It's rare in the offseason that the Bills capture national headlines, but what Bean did on Wednesday did so. And it wasn't just because of the volume of moves that he made, but it was the intention behind those moves. It was not just to clear cap for this year and be functional for this year from a salary cap perspective. It was also done very intentionally to not kick future numbers down the road to 25 and to 26. They clearly valued at One Bills Drive, JJ, future flexibility. So to take these moves into their full context, I think it's worth having a discussion about what it means for the Bills in the 2024 season, but what potential doors these moves open up for future years, particularly in 25 and 26, because most notable to me, we didn't see a Deion Dawkins extension. We didn't see a Taron Johnson extension in this either. And we didn't see a restructure of Dawson Knox. That tells me, future looking forward, that the Bills are going to be very, very careful moving forward with some of these veteran contracts about kicking money down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think it shows that Brandon Bean, I think that he has declared that the Bills championship window is open in his mind by really leaning into what I believe is going to be a year over year practice of 1 year vet minimum deals for team or for players that would like to join a team that will be in contention at the end of the year. I think that that's the thing is, you know, he acknowledges that Josh Allen is probably a top three, top five quarterback in the league, unequivocally. And he knows that he can dangle Josh Allen's presence, this Bills roster, the organization's successes in front of some of these vet minimum deals and say, listen, you want to do some ring chasing? Come join us. Be part of the run that pushes us past the Chiefs and in the AFC to represent in the Super Bowl. And so I think that that's also what this move indicates is that, you know, it's kind of boastful, right? It's to say that the Bills are a year-over-year contender. We can get your services for cheaper than the opponents. And, you know, we do not need to kick money down the road. We do not need to clear up all this space and overpay for people because you want to play for us. We don't have to entice you to play for, you know, to play in Buffalo. We're the desired location.
Absolutely. And this was a zag on Bean's part, as he has tended to do, I think, as GM for the Buffalo Bills. It's not that he bucks conventional wisdom all the time, JJ, but when you look at the drafting of Josh Allen, to the extended period of time after he had re-signed Allen to that mega money deal that they continued to invest in a veteran presence on this roster. You and I talked about maybe they needed to start resetting some of these positions, most notably safety, last season or even two seasons ago, to stay ahead of the eventual Josh Allen salary bump. And Bean didn't do that. He did the exact opposite, where he stuck with this philosophy of signing veteran floor raisers year after year after year, extending a lot of these guys year after year after year, till he came to this sort of straw that breaks the camel's back moment, where he had to do something about the roster construction against the cap. And then it is a complete 180 from how he has built this roster in the past. With all of these veteran cuts, they're now going to be forced, I think, with the exception of a couple of key areas that I think they can address in free agency, they're going to be forced to play high variance young players on cheap deals that are contract controlled for many, many years. It is a overnight almost shift in philosophy. But I think, to your point, acknowledgement of the reality that the window is open as long as you have Josh Allen on the roster. So building around Josh intentionally year after year is the way that they're going to go, it seems like. And not to say that they haven't valued Josh, but I think we can all agree when you look at the way they have spent free agent capital, investing so heavily in the defensive line, where they have sunk a lot of their extension money, with the exception of Stephon Diggs and Dawson Knox, it's been on the defensive side of the ball. This, to me, is a signal that they're ready to finally pry the Super Bowl window open and build intentionally around Josh. Because the players that you can get on the offensive side and free agency in the draft are going to be much more cost affordable for the most part than the guys that are going to be looking to fill spots on the defensive side of the ball. So it's going to be fascinating to see how this team approaches free agency, JJ. But before we get into any of that, because I do feel like we've got to reset the table now from all of our carefully planned free agent preview and draft preview, I think we got to talk about, in specificity, the moves that were made and kind of what that signals to you and I about where this roster is headed for the 24 season and beyond. So do you want to dig into some of these
moves?
Yeah, for
sure. I mean, we can just run down what the moves were to first. And I think that, you know, that's a good place to start. So on the offensive side of the ball, the Buffalo Bills, of course, traded Ryan Rick Bates to Chicago. The team that was courting him when they signed, they matched the offer sheet and signed him to an extended contract 2 years ago. He had 1 year with 35 snaps last year as an outstanding backup, kind of all do it all, versatile offensive lineman. But then they sent him to Chicago for a fifth round pick. So they added in their middle rounds to the war chest. And I think both of us kind of assumed that with Ryan Bates being traded away, that Mitch Morse's safety on the roster was pretty much locked in, because Bates was the number one backup at center. But lo and behold, that was not the case. Morse was about $8.3 million savings to be cut, and he was. They cut a Pro Bowl caliber center, probably above average, and I think would be considered a valuable contract. I think he's 31.
31,
and so
yeah.
Above average centers who start in this league are paid or around $8 million. So it seems like it was really leaning into Connor McGovern moving over from guard to center. The Bills definitely let that leak, because I think that they, you know, probably wanted any free agents out there, especially on the offensive side of the ball, to not, you know, to look at the Bills as a landing spot and say, okay, they have a complete line, because that was leaked through Tim Graham of The Athletic, and then it made its rounds online that the Bills' plan, the way they explained it to McGovern and David Edwards, who they re-signed, was that McGovern would move over to center. He'd played some snaps in the NFL in that position, not many. And then David Edwards, who's a natural left guard, would fill in at left guard. So they still have a complete starting line. And I'm actually okay with that starting line. They are worse at this point in time in terms of depth, but I think that it is a younger line of people, and that is something that we've wanted them to get towards.
It's also a heavier line, JJ. And I think, you know, so you and I got into it over text on Tuesday night when the Bates trade got announced. I didn't like the Bates move, but I was with you because I thought it was a clear signal that, all right, Mitch Morse finally got a full healthy season as a Buffalo Bill under his belt. They're going to, because they could have restructured his deal and done a base salary conversion and kicked more money down the road and still saved about $3 or $4 million under the cap and have kept Morse on the roster. Because the Bates move, it doesn't save them a whole lot of money against the cap. He was scheduled to make just over $5 million, I want to say, this season, and his dead cat hit was right around $4.1 million. So the Bates move, to me, was a signal. If you're not going to get cap savings, it was a signal that Morse is your guy of the future. Then the following day, he gets cut for his full salary savings of $8.4 million. And we get the news that McGovern, who hasn't played meaningful snaps at center since his days at Penn State, moves over into that role. So, JJ, I think this move, when all of those factors are evaluated, this move is the most surprising to me because it messes with a formula that for the first time in 7 years under this regime, they got right on the offensive line. And you and I have both been critical on this pod about the way they have managed resources, development, and snaps along that offensive line. I was just today, because I miss Buffalo Bills football, I was watching the NFL Network. I was home with my kids, and they had the 2021 Tennessee Titans regular season game. That was the game where I think that was the only time Josh has ever like failed to complete a 4th-and-1 in any situation. The Bills end up losing that game. And I was just re-watching that game, and Josh was running for his life pretty much the entire game. And seeing that, and then thinking back to what this Bills brain trust has done to the offensive line to dismantle what was a top five line by a lot of metrics, it made me a little bit unsettled. I understand the salary cap metrics around it. I even understand the offensive philosophy around it, because this to me isn't just a salary cap move. This is what Joe Brady ultimately, I think, our first big sign of what a Joe Brady offense is going to look like. And it's going to feature a bigger offensive line to take on some of these fast and ever decreasing, these tiny defenses a la the Dallas Cowboys. I think they're going to want to just put some brutes on the front of that line, some real big maulers, and they're going to want to establish themselves in the run game more and more. So the Morse move, when all those factors are taken into consideration, to me, it makes sense in my brain. But my heart tells me that for a couple of reasons, I should be concerned about this move. One, because he was a really true locker room leader. Like, he was a voice of reason and I think a calming, stabilizing presence. In a locker room full of veterans, he was the one that everybody looked towards on the offensive side of the ball to kind of set the tenor and set the tone. I think they're going to be missing that very much so, because McDermott, as we know, relies a lot on his player leaders to help set the tone day in and day out in that locker room. So I think my heart tells me that Morse move is going to leave a big gaping hole when it comes to player leadership in the locker room. Secondly, this is a move that you can read either one of two ways. Supreme confidence in Aaron Cromer to develop anybody that they bring in to play any position along that line. It is either confidence, or on the flip side of that, tremendous hubris, again, by an organization that in 6 out of the last 7 years has absolutely gotten the protection wrong for their franchise QB. So the Morse move to me was the one that left me feeling the most wanting, JJ, especially because you basically just traded your two primary centers off the roster, and you still could have gotten a cap savings with Morse had you done a base salary conversion.
Yeah, no, I get that. And I think that one thing that you said in there, it kind of, it piqued me a little bit, because I think that that's exactly what it is. is Bean always talks about how the last game you play informs your offseason. And there are a couple of things that they could not do against the Kansas City Chiefs, or that the things they did well in the game and the things they could not do will inform how they build this team in the offseason. The thing they did well was play clock control, time management, but they could have done better with a more established rushing offense. And I think that, you know, you can say that losing Morrison Bates, you know, reduces your capabilities in a rushing offense. But I think the thing that you said that kind of triggered me a little bit was they got bigger on the front. And I think that's really the purpose, is that Brady comes from that, you know, college tree. He comes ultimately up from the Sean Payton tree of coaching. And so he has a definite appreciation and respect for the run game and how it can work in the modern NFL. And I think you're right. I think there's a trend to move to lighter boxes in terms of weight poundage, lighter linebackers who are coverage specialists across the league. We see that happening all over. The Bills are even one of those teams who has that. So the ability to kind of match up and really impose your will, control the clock, keep opposing quarterbacks like Patrick Mahomes, Joe Burrow, Tua Tagovailoa off the field, I think that might be the move that this is signaling, because they increase the average weight across that line. And in terms of the locker room leadership, I think that just from what everyone sees of the public persona of Deion Dawkins, he's not a calming presence, elder statesman. He's a bit of a showman, kind of a clown at times, right? And so I wonder where they get that from. Who's going to be that person? Is it McGovern? Is it Edwards? They've both got a couple of years under their belt. We don't know what they could be like as leaders, because they probably deferred to Morris. Of course they did. He was a Pro Bowl caliber center who had cut his teeth, you know, with Patrick Mahomes up under his butt, and then moved on to Josh Allen and was a calming presence for a rookie QB in his first few seasons in the league. So, you know, I think there's a lot there. And I'm excited to see what they can do. And I do think that they have ultimate confidence in Aaron Kromer because of what he was able to do with Osiris Torrance, because of how he was able to assimilate Connor McGovern into this offense pretty quickly, because of how it meshed and blended. And they certainly got lucky with no injuries, but they also were able to really create a unit that covered each other's backs, that were able to handle twists and stunts. As the season went on, I think we both saw that some of the weakness that was, you know, earlier in the year with speed rushes, twists, stunts, delayed blitzes, kind of peaker blitzes, those sorts of things, that started to get cleaned up. And that's what I think, you know, triggered some of these moves, is they said, okay, we know that we can bring brand new pieces in and get them on board. And we're ready to get younger, cheaper. This is a very deep offensive line draft, especially in the middle to late rounds. If you're willing to take a player that has either not a lot of starts under their belt in college, but a lot of traits, or a player who has a lot of starts, but not a lot of elite traits, so they have a higher floor, this is a good draft for that in the rounds 3 through 7.
Tanner Bordellini from Wisconsin is a name that immediately comes to mind. We had talked on the last pod about the Duke kid, right? His name escapes me. Graham Barton, I think his name is. He's played tackle, but in the NFL, he profiles to the inside. Frazier, the kid out of West Virginia.
Javon Foster out of
Jackson
Missouri.
Powers Johnson. Yeah. Yep. Jackson Powers Johnson is another one we talked about. I think, though, based on still the amount of veteran cap hit they've got in this offensive line, I think you look 4th, 5th, even 6th round. And I think a guy like Tanner Bordellini from Wisconsin, 6'4", 310, is going to become more of the profile they're going to look at when it comes to their interior and their center position, for sure. I think Brady just wants to get big, and he wants to push some of these light boxes around, and he wants to let James Cook have a day. And you know what? I'm okay with that. As long as they also, once these defenses start to condense and bring guys in and dirty up the box a little bit, as long as he can develop a scheme that'll then be able to take the top off the defense, right? Because that's what it's all about. That's what it's all about.
No, I agree completely. And I'll throw a couple of other, you know, I'll throw some alphabet soup names out at you of players I like late in the draft. Nathan Thomas out of Louisiana. Lafayette, that's Raging Cajuns, is a tackle who could probably slide into guard. Trevor Keegan out of Michigan just went on that championship run.
Big boy.
Could be had in a later round. Not a superb athlete, but definitely has the chops starting against some good opposition. And then Hunter Norzad, Penn State center, sixth round maybe. So there's a couple of guys. There's some guys late in the game. Georgia, Cedric Van Pran, maybe a fourth rounder. He's the center from Georgia. So there's some options, I think, that the Bills could tap into.
And it was notable, too, because they re-signed Edwards, which you and I would hope they would do, granted, as a depth piece. Right now, technically on the depth chart, he is their starting left guard in place of McGovern. That being said, though, the organization said he'll have the opportunity to compete for a starting job. So they have Edwards' name in the starting lineup in pencil, not pen. It's going to be really interesting to see as we dive a little bit more into, and free agency will tell us a lot, but as we dive more into the draft and as we sift through some of the breadcrumbs, do the Bills, I mean, we've been talking about wide receiver round one, DT, safety. I mean, are the Bills going to take an interior offensive lineman round two or three? I think it is absolutely on the table now, JJ, for sure, especially because these guys are so hard to find. And when you find them, you've got to pay them a boatload of money after their rookie contract. Who's the LA Rams guy? They just Kevin Dotson. He played great for the Rams. He just signed for $16 million
offensive
lineman.
I remember, absolutely wild, right? 4 years ago,
crazy.
You could have the best. Who's the guard from Indy who was so good? Quentin Nelson. I think Quentin Nelson's deal he signed after his rookie season was like $8 million. It was not, per average annual value. And like he was known immediately as like a league, top of the league's guard right out of the gate. And so 4 or 5 years ago, you could have an interior line for $30 million that would get you a 1,000-yard rusher no matter who you put behind them. And now it's, that's a one guy. That's two guys. Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's almost becoming like the running back position where there's, when you look at a lot of draft charts, there is not a huge amount of value taking a guard in the first round or taking interior offensive lineman in the first round. But because these guys keep the pocket clean up the middle for a lot of these mobile QBs that can use their legs, and because they open up escape holes for a lot of these QBs, they're getting paid. They're getting paid on their second and on their third contracts. So we could be entering a realm where Brandon Bean does his best Philadelphia Eagles impression and is just always throwing a second or a third round pick every year in an offensive lineman. Now, I think Bills Mafia would prefer to see that as opposed to throwing a second and third round pick every year at a running back, right? So, yeah, for sure. So the sea change in roster management, JJ, is going to be fascinating to observe here. Absolutely. Let's run through some other moves, because I think there was one that we're going to get to that was equally, if not more surprising than the more.
So we'll stay on the offensive side of the ball for the two other lesser contracts that everyone sort of expected. Deontay Hardy, Nyheim Hines, those are each about $5 million that they save. They don't really eat a lot of dead cap. Deontay Hardy, other than that punt return in the Miami Dolphins game that helped kind of turn the tide and clinch the AFC East, had a very quiet season. I think he also had a third down reception against the Chiefs that was clutch in that game. Nyheim Hines, of course, was in the unfortunate jet skiing accident before the season kicked off, tore his ACL, was recovering from that. And so, both of those cuts, sort of everybody was expecting. There's not a lot to lose in those. I think there's guys like Deontay Hardy and Nyheim Hines you can find for $1.75 million, vet minimum deals to catch kicks for you, to return kicks. But it does create a hole in special teams. And speaking of special teams, the other person they cut was Saron Neal. And he was a special teams ace and a somewhat of a liability on defense. I think that he at times was utilized to try to take away, tight ends and be like a big nickel in certain defensive sets. And most of the times he was on the field for defense, it did not go super well. He was not making impact plays, splash plays. He was sometimes out of position on run fits. And so Saron Neal never turned into a player who could really offer you anything on defense. And for that reason, I think they had to move on. I think it was like $3 or $4 million on the books that they cleaned up by moving on from Saron Neal. So those are some of the lower tier ones. Is Poyer the one you want to talk about next?
Poyer was the one that really yes. hit me in my heart the most.
You know
out of
him.
Any
You've
of
met
these cuts. So I had the good fortune of helping to book him at a previous professional stop that I made at a previous company. We brought him in to talk with some of our students about his recovery from alcoholism, how it impacted him not only as a professional and a player, but as a family man. And to this date, you know, I'll still talk with some of my former colleagues because I've since moved on from that particular organization. But I'll still talk with some of my colleagues and they will note how impactful and memorable that talk was. So not only do I have a tremendous amount of respect for Jordan Poyer, the player, but Jordan Poyer, the human being, and having the good fortune of seeing how inspirational and how empathetic he was to an auditorium of a 1,000 students who he didn't know, but still chose to give his time to. It was a great moment, not just as a fan, but as a now former educator, to see someone like that give themselves to that group in that way. So Poyer, from a player perspective and a human being perspective, will always be in my personal Hall of Fame. That's the one I think emotionally that hit me the hardest, JJ, but it was not the one that surprised me the most.
Yes.
Von Miller. So this originally got posted in the media as a contract restructure. A contract restructure typically kicks money down the road. That is not what happened here. This was a full renegotiation where the Bills can still get out of Von Miller's deal after the end of the season. His cap hit for next season only went up about $1 million as a result of the renegotiation. So they're not kicking money down the road. And he took a real pay cut, going from about $17 million against the cap all the way down to $8 million. And that number can go back up to $20 million if he hits certain incentives and certain markers. But that money won't hit this year's cap. That'll hit next year's cap if he reaches any of those incentive benchmarks. Yeah. JJ, we talked about this. The Bills had no leverage whatsoever to get Von Miller to take a pay cut. This is like some Brandon Bean Houdini stuff, because we thought anyone that would sign on the current roster an incentive-laden deal would be Trey White, because not a lot of money was guaranteed, and the Bills could cut him and still recoup a lot of their cap. Miller, his dead cap hit was more than what his salary cap hit would have been had he remained on the roster. He could have easily just said, nope, I've got a contract. I'm going to collect my $17.5 million. And he took a $10 million pay cut. Like, what? How did
See,
Bean
I don't
do
know
that
Bean did that. I think that Miller did that. I think that, I'm sure Bean started, opened the conversation, but I think, yeah.
I was going to say, there's no way Von walked hat
he didn't
hand
walk
into
in
Bean's
and say
office.
Like,
hey,
you
man,
know,
listen,
yeah,
I didn't
let
play
me give
great
you some of this money
year.
Back. No.
Right. All the off the field stuff. Sorry about that. Here's 10 mil against
I'll say,
the cap, right?
I don't think, you know, certainly Bean opened the conversation, but I do think that credit needs to be given to Miller, who wants to be a GM in his post playing career, and who wants to, this is in a lot of ways, it is Miller broadcasting to the league, to teams that might be hiring a GM immediately after he retires. I understand how the cap works. It's that he knows, as a player who is hungry to set an NFL record by winning a third Super Bowl ring with three different teams, it is a savvy move of a vet who has that goal in mind. And if you've ever heard him talk, he's like all about positivity. He's all about like manifesting your reality and that sort of thing. It is about a player kind of dedicating himself to this thing of post playing career. I might want to work in a front office. I want to declare that I know how the cap works. I know that my goal of getting a third Super Bowl ring is not going to be as easy to attain if I don't have somebody rushing across from me or a good healthy rotation or a solid defensive tackle to kind of gobble up double teams. And so I think in a lot of ways it's a self-serving, it's his one, it's self-serving in that he knows he'll be more successful if they have some cap room to play in free agency a little bit. And two, it is also, it's a little bit of, you know, him betting on himself because he can make more money this season than he was guaranteed to make if he hits his incentives. And so he has incentives that stack at 2 sacks, 4 sacks, 6 sacks, 8 sacks, 10.5 sacks, and finally at 15 sacks. He has not had 10 or more sacks since 2018. So those last two rungs of that ladder that jump like 2 million and 1 million respectively are pretty unlikely. And that's really how the Bills got this cap savings is we've discussed on the pods in the past about unlikely to be earned incentives. So you don't actually have to count on your cap if you have in someone's contract that they'll get $10 million for getting 10 sacks. If in the immediate prior season, they did not achieve 10 sacks, that's not likely to be earned. That doesn't count this year. If they do achieve those 10 sacks, it does count, but it counts in the next year of the cap. And so for those reasons, you know, I think that it's really him, one, understanding how the cap works and that he needs help on the defensive line, and they have a lot of holes there right now. And so giving them some relief will actually help him. And then two, it's about betting on himself because he's a prideful man and he wants to prove that he wasn't complete wash this late in his career after the injury. And so, you know, we'll see. Like, this is, we knew all along with how the contract was structured before this renegotiation happened that he wasn't going anywhere. And that the best the Bills could hope for was that they would have a healthier, more impactful Von Miller, you know, in this coming season. And he is sort of with this renegotiation declaring that he plans to be more impactful because he, you know, there's a lot of millions of dollars sitting on the table if he is able to make an impact.
I know it still though. Von Miller, everything you said was correct. Let me just put it that way. And I think your analysis of Miller's personality is spot on. For anyone who's read any of these player profiles that Miller's been a part of throughout the course of his career in Denver, LA, and now Buffalo, what you said, JJ, is 110% on target. Miller, though, is still part of a union.
Oh yeah, they were right? Pissed, I bet.
And
players' union.
I've got to imagine that was a contentious conversation with the union. Because all of these scales are set by, you know, veteran ceilings and stuff like that. Von giving up money isn't just about him giving up money. It's now the next deal that an organization tries to get done with a veteran of his caliber and his resume is going to be like, well, listen, man, Von took $8.5 million, right?
And he's
like,
going to be a Hall of Famer.
2024 season. Yeah. That's our new benchmark, right? And he's going to the Hall of Fame and he's got 2 Super Bowl rings, right? I mean, so I've got to imagine that this was contentious in ways that we may never know behind the scenes for Miller and Miller's camp.
I was going to say, refer to my previous statement about him declaring to NFL teams that might want to hire a GM. I know how the business works. I'm not player friendly. I'm team friendly.
Dude, this is 4-dimensional chess, right? This is 4-dimensional chess. On Miller's part, 100%. But no, I mean, this was, other than the Morse move, I think this was the most surprising move. JJ, I want to go backwards and talk a little bit more in depth about Poyer. Because the Bills, a lot of the cuts that they went through on Wednesday, they lost a lot of veteran leadership on that defensive side of the ball. Guys that helped establish the culture that we now enjoy as Bills fans. Playoff caliber, championship caliber, however tropey we may think it now sounds 7 years into this experiment with Sean McDermott and Brandon Bean. Guys like Jordan Poyer, guys like Trey White were the cornerstones of establishing that culture and that philosophy. And now both are gone. And you and I talked in very real terms that this was probably going to be the year for one, if not both of them. Right after Trey got injured this season, you and I talked pretty early on about this could be it for Trey. Did we think that Bean had the, I don't want to say like coldness, right? The ability to sort of like disassociate from the move. Like this was an emotional move, I think, regardless. I didn't know if they were going to be able to be all business about Trey, because the bit, like, had this been Bill Belichick, Trey probably would have been cut the moment the Bills were eliminated from the playoffs, right? I didn't know if Bean had it in him to cut Trey, but he did, and it was the smart business move. The Poyer thing you and I talked about as the season started to wrap up, especially after Micah Hyde's wife released what was basically a retirement video on Instagram, and we started to talk in real terms, too, about Poyer and Hyde both no longer being a part of that team. Now those things have manifested into reality. And I think from a position value perspective, there's going to be a lot of debate about, oh, well, you know, Poyer was in decline. He was pretty much a box safety. You can bring in a guy like Jeremy Chinn and get an upgrade. Sure. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about performance on the field. What is going to be hard, if not damn near impossible, to replace JJ is that those were the yes. banner men for this era of Buffalo Bills football. And it is not going to be any small task to replace what they meant to this fan base and that locker room heading into next
season.
Not
to mention that they were ambassadors of the McDermott style of defense. They were the ones who taught the sixth round Dane Jackson and the undrafted free agent Levi Wallace. They were the ones who were able to translate, you know, the defense for those new players coming in the door and make sure everyone was playing as a unit on the same page. There is a big step back that we should probably expect early in the season, especially with Bobby Babich as a new presumed play caller on the defensive side of the ball, to add to the fact that you don't have as much vocal leadership on that side of the ball, missing Micah Hyde, Jordan Poyer, Tre'Davious White. I think that part of the reason they were willing to let Poyer and White go is what they saw from Terrell Bernard. And I don't know if you listened to the Sean McDermott press conference at the Combine. He mentioned that at one point in maybe it was the Miami game or the Steelers game, at one point he went down the sideline to give the defense a pep talk about closing the game out. And before he even get to the assembled players, he realized that Bernard was already there giving them that pep talk about getting a stop. And so, you know, that's the kind of leadership that I think there is a new vocal leader. I think that Milano's never been that. He's always been a, you know, talk with his pads type. And I don't know what Taylor Rapp is like, but we should expect there to be a step back because there's a huge leadership void on that back end, especially in the DB room. Depending on who they bring in, we got to trust the process on this one, though.
Well, and I think that there is a trickle down domino effect, if you will, that starts with the replacement and the potential leveling off or even depreciation in play at the safety position heading into next year. I think about Taron Johnson, who you and I both agree, for my money, best nickel corner in the league. And I love the way Taron Johnson plays. He is an all-pro style player and extraordinarily valuable to that team. But I encourage Bills fans to go look at Taron Johnson's splits. And you got to pick it out and you got to do a little bit of homework. Look at his game logs when Poyer played versus when Poyer did not play. Some of Taron Johnson's worst career games happened when Jordan Poyer was out, because of the safety net that Poyer and Hyde both presented in that backfield, it allowed Taron Johnson to attack in the run game the way that he did. It allowed him to go with his first instinct and first reaction. Not having that level of safety net has a, like I said, a ripple effect across the rest of the defense. I know safeties as a position are being devalued, much like running backs are. But in the McDermott defense, where DBs are supposed to have not only their coverage assignments, but their run gap assignments also on lock, I think we're going to see, I don't think it's just going to be in coverage, JJ, that we're going to start to see some variance. I think it's going to be in the run game, an area of weakness already for the Bills, because of the way they rely on their DBs to work in unison and covering that end of opposing teams' playbook. So, again, I love Poyer. It was emotional to see him finally cut as we expected he was going to be cut. I'm still sort of recovering from that. But make no mistake, even with his decline in play from last season to this past season, there is going to be a ripple effect across the rest of that defense that we're going to see in the very early weeks, to your point, the Bills and Bobby Babich have to adjust to. You can't just take guys like that out of the lineup, plug and play some other guys, and expect the same level and same caliber of production.
I agree with that. And I think, too, you know, you mentioned that, Taron Johnson has played his best ball with Poyer on the field, and he had his only all-pro season to date with Poyer in the box with him, which is like something that's worth mentioning. But we will see. I think that you'd also, if you looked at those splits, see that Taron Johnson played his best games when Matt Milano was healthy, too, because that, you know, that kind of fast-flowing defense. Yeah.
Yeah. Fair point. Yeah.
That's a fair question, though, because Matt Milano has had a bit of an injury history. So hopefully he's able to go this year and play the whole year, no interruptions. And so, you know, it's a lot to wonder about. I'll say this, though. I know there's a lot of uncertainty on the defensive side of the ball with the roster build as it stands right now. I'm excited. I'm kind of cautiously excited to see what happens at the end of, you know, training camp and into the season with what the final 53 looks like, because this is the thing, you know, like, be careful what you wish for. You just might get it. You and I have been talking about a younger, faster, cheaper defense for a long time. I think we're going to see one this season.
We certainly are. We certainly are. So let's do some math real quick, right? Because the Trey White cap savings is designated as a post June 1 cut, which means the Bills are not going to see his $10 million in change until after that date. So according to SpotTrack right now, the Bills are sitting at about minus $7 million against the cap. But I think if you look at some of the NFLPA numbers that have come out on contracts for next year, there was some shenanigans to Ed Oliver's contract. I believe it has not been announced yet, but I think Bills fans should expect an Ed Oliver restructure coming here, in the next week or so. We still haven't seen the Josh Allen restructure either, which would bring the Bills a full $23 million under the cap, add in that $10 million post June 1. And I think the Bills are probably going to be walking into free agency with functional cap space of probably, if my math is right, somewhere between $25 million and $31 million, JJ, which is more than enough money to stabilize the roster and get up to 53. And I think take a run at re-signing a guy like DaQuan Jones or AJ Epineza. I think that is now in the realm of possibility based on where the salary cap numbers hit. And then you need to look at future savings as well. The Buffalo Bills, as it stands today, are already $38 million under the projected cap for 2025. You can get out of the Dawson Knox contract next season. You can get out of the Von Miller contract next season. You can trade Stephon Diggs next season, and it won't hurt as much. There is a very real world, JJ, in 2025 where the Buffalo Bills are playing around with $50 or even $60 million in free agent money to spend.
And it gets, it's going to change as they sign contracts to players that they, you know, draft and develop. But in 2026, they have over $100 million of space as it stands today. So,
right.
Like, the cap. This season, this terrible Wednesday of so many stalwarts on the team being, you know, sent packing and cut, was really our kind of Old Yeller or Where the Red Fern Grows moment of, you know, behind the woodshed with the rabid dog, Tre'Davious White.
So many good middle school reading references right there.
Right.
Now we're going to find
our way out of the woods, like Hatchet by Gary Paulson.
Oh, yeah. My God. Keep it coming.
So anyway, It's a wild world, and I think that, you know, what we're going to see is cheaper, younger, of course, but I think we're also going to see, you know, this is the point I texted this to you also, is all of the people out there who are kind of, you know, oh, you know, Sean McDermott can't get over the hump. Oh, Sean McDermott is wasting an excellent, talented roster year over year because he's an inadequate coach and they can't get to the championship. Maybe that's true, but also you're going to have a real litmus test this year, which is we're going to see what coaching does with Sean McDermott making multiple decisions, moving on from Ken Dorsey, bringing Joe Brady on and then making him no longer the interim and a full-time offensive coordinator, promoting Bobby Babich, a young upstart kind of exciting defensive mind, to the DC position, which caused two longtime veteran defensive assistants to leave, Eric Washington and I forget the safeties coach that just left, DB's coach.
Oh, I keep wanting to say John McDonald, but that is not the name. Hang on.
Anyway.
Yeah,
He loses two of his longtime kind of, you know, two of his longtime close cabinet members on that defensive side of the ball purely to, you know, go with the hot hand, go with the youth movement. And that, I think, is an indication of, okay, you know, folks who may doubt that Sean McDermott is a good coach, you'll get some proof, better or worse, to either support your argument or blow your argument out of the water, depending on how well the Bills team this season is with a completely new roster, especially on the defensive side of the ball in a lot of ways, a rehashed, restructured, younger offensive line, possibly one or two new offensive weapons, and, you know, the safeties, Hyde and Poyer, that had been kind of the best duo in the league for so many years, both off the roster. So we're going to really see what he can, what his acting, you know, his chops are as an acting, you know, CEO with both a DC and an OC in place as well. And Dan, are you still searching for our DB's coach?
Yeah, I am still looking for some reason. My Google machine is not working.
Damn you, internet.
It should be working right now. I know. For whatever reason, and I live in the great northern tundra of upstate New York, whenever rains here, JJ, our internet goes to absolute crap. It is the absolute weirdest function of weather in upstate New York that I have ever seen in my entire life. It's absolutely, absolutely crazy. But anyway, sir, we have work to do. We had meticulously, and I would say in a craftsman-like way, laid out our free agency preview and needs and our draft preview and needs. And all of that, my friend, is now out the window with what, again, we can't say it enough. Like, teams don't do this stuff. GMs will continue to keep Super Bowl windows open, kick veteran money down the road year after year after year, and treat the salary cap like it is not a real thing. Brandon Bean did the exact opposite of that. And now, JJ, we're left kind of with a lot of, like, in wonder at what he did, the spectacle of what Wednesday was, and the emotional tone that came with all of that. But also, too, we're left with some pretty significant roster holes. And we know that Bean likes to head into the draft, being able to take BPA, best player available, and not draft for need. Dude, the Bills are going to be drafting for need because there's no way they can fill all these holes in free agency. So it's going to be interesting. So for those of you listening at home, we are going to take the next week or so to redo all of our free agency and all of our draft profiles and bring you some fresh content in this new, brave new world of Buffalo Bills roster management that we find ourselves in, JJ.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, as you so, you know, aptly put it, Bean lit the table on fire and jumped through it. So we have to build it back up and reset this thing.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I'm looking forward to it, though. I am 110% on board with this. Yeah,
absolutely.
I think it's going to be great. Yeah. I think it's going to be great. So for all of you listening at home, hopefully you have emotionally recovered from what was a very trying week for Bills Mafia, and hopefully there will be sunnier skies ahead of us. both figuratively and in reality, because we are still dealing with a fair amount of cloudy weather by us. And I am ready for spring, sir. I am ready to move on from the winter. But for all of you listening at home, thanks for being with us tonight. Like, share, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, Google, Apple, Spotify. And as always, go Bills.